This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Seth Meyers has had a career that any comedian in America would kill for. He did improv for a few years before landing a spot on Saturday Night Live. And on the show, Meyers was a sketch performer, a writer, then head writer, and he hosted SNL's Weekend Update along with Amy Poehler. Eventually, NBC gave him a show of his own, Late Night with Seth Meyers. In 2017, staff writer Ariel Levy sat down with Meyers at the New Yorker Festival, and she began, always a good place to start, at the beginning.
I happen to know that the person who most inspired him to become a comedian, the funniest person you know, is your dad.
Yes.
Yes. So tell us about his sense of humor. Give us a sense of the humor that...
Well, I will say my father, who is in finance, is the funniest person not only I know, but I feel like he's been the funniest person in any office he's ever worked in. My dad gives away tickets to my show pretty much all the time. Like, my dad could bump into someone at a restaurant and will apologize for bumping into them, and it will end with those people getting tickets to my show. But a lot of times people from the bank that he works at will come to the show, and they will say to me, the show was so funny tonight, you're not as funny as your dad. Like, even they want to tell me. Which on an esteem level isn't great, but I do agree with them.
But yeah. It's true.
Yeah,
it's
and my dad, I will say, at a very age-inappropriate time, introduced my brother and I to Monty Python, SNL, uh-huh. Richard Pryor. I feel like we were probably the only 11-year-olds who were listening to Richard Pryor. If you haven't, a lot of words that aren't for 11-year-olds in those early Richard Pryor albums. So that was his taste.
Is there a your dad joke that's like a classic of the genre?
No, my dad's not. My dad's a storyteller. He's not a joke guy. This, I will tell a brief story about my dad. This is, I don't know if this is really about how funny my dad is, but it is about how crazy my dad is. My dad feels very strongly about justice and being right, and he has a little bit of a temper. We grew up in New Hampshire. If you've ever been to New Hampshire, a lot of trees. There we go, live free or die. And my dad had wanted us to have a backyard, and we just had like basically woods. So we had all these trees cut down. But then we had stumps in the backyard, and my dad was trying to figure out how to get rid of the stumps. And there was someone else in the neighborhood who was having work done, and there was basically a machine that would get rid of stumps. Anyway, we drove by, and my dad said to these guys, hey, will you come and remove these stumps? And they said, yeah, sure, we'll do it tomorrow. And then they didn't. And so the next day, we're driving to school, my brother and I in the back seat, and my dad stopped and said, hey, you said you were gonna do it. Will you do it tomorrow? And they said, absolutely, and then they didn't do it. And then the third day, it took 3 days for my dad to do this, he stopped the car. He parked it next to these trucks and said to my brother and I, he looked back in the back seat and said, it'll be fine, which is a terrifying thing to hear. And then he got out in his business suit and he laid down in front of one of their trucks. And these guys walked over and said, what are you doing? And he said, I would rather die than have these stumps in my backyard another day. And so they said, hey, man, because, again, they didn't know him well enough to not think he wasn't crazy. And they said, we will take care of this tomorrow. And then my dad got back in the car, and we were driving to school. And my brother said, why would you do that with us in the car? And my dad said, it wouldn't have worked without you in the car. That tells you a lot about my dad.
Your mom is, of course, Madame Myers.
She was a famous French teacher.
French teacher who helped you to cut school all the time. Why did she do that?
My mom really liked hanging out with my brother and I. If we even hinted that we had a tickle of something in our throat, she would not only let us stay home, she would then also stay home. My mom retired after 25 years as a school teacher, I'm pretty sure with zero sick days left on her. She would just, then she would go to a video store and rent movies, and we would just hang out with her all the time. She was, she continues to be an incredible mom.
And then you went to Northwestern, which is a good school, so you must have gone to high school sometimes.
I did. Yeah.
And then when you went to Chicago, obviously there's a famous comedy scene there.
Yeah.
Were you immediately super involved in it? And did you know any of your future SNL cast members when you were in Chicago?
Yeah, so I was a radio, TV, film, I was a film major. That was my plan when I went to Northwestern. And I realized right away that great filmmakers have to have an incredible amount of patience, which I don't feel as though I have. And there was also an improv troupe at Northwestern, and I saw that, and I think improvisers have no patience at all. It's the perfect thing. If you have no patience and you don't want to prepare for anything, basically improv is for you.
It's your jam.
So I immediately started going, taking improv classes in Chicago and falling in love with that. I remember seeing one of the most informative moments of my young comedy career is I went to a show one night, and it was Amy Poehler and Tina Fey were doing a two-person show in Chicago, and the show was called Women of Color. They did it one time before Amy left to move to New York and start UCB. So I saw the only performance of that show and was blown away.
And then you went to Amsterdam. Why did you do that?
It's important when people hear you went to Amsterdam that you point out that you had a reason. Other than that's where weed is legal. But two Chicago guys started a Second City-style improv theater in Amsterdam. And they would have auditions in Chicago for it. And so I auditioned for and got hired to work full-time at an improv comedy theater in Amsterdam, which was the best 2 years of my life. And then that was where I met a lot of people that I continued to work with over the years. Jason Sudeikis from SNL was out there. Kate Cannon, who wrote the movie Pitch Perfect. Jordan Peele from Key & Peele was out there when I was there. So it was really exciting. Ike Barinholtz, who's on the Mindy Project. But there was a lot of really cool people who were out there at the same time.
And how do you get from there to SNL?
So I come back from Amsterdam, and I met a fellow comedian out there named Jill Benjamin. We came back to Chicago, and we started doing a two-person show in Chicago called Pickups and Hiccups. Wasn't great. And that show we did a lot in Chicago. We did it at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. We did it in London. We did it at the Singapore Comedy Festival. And then we were randomly doing it one night in Chicago, and a talent scout from SNL saw it, and that started the process.
And then the process is what? Is make us a tape.
So it was so hard to make a tape, guys. I should have gotten hired just on the fact that I made a tape. A friend of mine sent it to me recently. I could only watch about 15 seconds of it before I was terrified and just started to sweat with like residual memory of how fear, like the fear. But it was one of those things, a tiny camera. I was standing in front of his like chest of drawers, and it was one of those little tapes that then you had to put into a VHS tape. It was a nightmare. But I sent that in. 6 months later, they asked for a second tape, and then about 6 months after that, I auditioned.
And then you immediately got hired as a performer.
Yes.
Okay, so let's see you performing early on. Yeah, let's.
Oh, no.
No, it's funny. Let's see the first clip, which is March Madness.
I don't like being a
stripper. You're going to like it.
I really don't like this. I'm very upset. I know what it is.
No, you're going to love it.
Ugh.
Here's the winner of this year's SNL Office Pool, Seth Meyers.
Should I say hello, losers?
Congratulations, Seth. You did a good job.
Yeah, what's that, Jimmy? I can't hear you all the way up here at the top. Ah, the sweet nectar of success.
Stop doing that.
Delicious!
Seth, why do you have to act like this?
Well, I'd like to tell you, Tina, but anyone stupid enough to think Kentucky was going to win the tournament wouldn't understand. I'm Tina Fey. No one can beat Kentucky.
Come on, it's just a pool, man. It's just a pool.
What's that? I can't hear you, Fallon. The rustle of your $10 bill is deafening. With money like this, the options are endless. Yay! 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 Yay!
You know, there are only 15 of us. You do realize you only won $150.
No, I did not realize that. In my excitement, I seem to have shanked my math pretty badly and added a zero or three to my winnings. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have a plasma TV and a cheetah to unbuy. A good day to you. Oh.
Seth Meyers, everybody. Seth Meyers.
Okay. I do want to point out that as a sketch performer on the show, what ultimately happened is Lorne Michaels decided, you know what you would be good at? Sitting behind a desk as yourself. So that was genuinely not enjoyable for me to watch.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It was, you know, I have to face it.
Tonight's the night,
yeah.
Then you become a writer.
Yeah.
Tell us about the difference between working there as a performer and a writer.
Well, as a performer can be a little bit lonelier in that all performers at SNL are expected to write, but if you have a week where none of your stuff gets picked, you then kind of become obviously less vital to the process. And there would be Thursdays where you weren't in any of the sketches that were rehearsing and you would just stay home all day. And it sounds awesome to have a Thursday off unless it means that you have it off because you failed, in which case it's not great. But as a writer on the show, even if you didn't get anything on, you would go to a rewrite table, you spend all day with writers, you try to, you know, add value by suggesting jokes. And so I really enjoyed that. I like being in rooms with writers, I still do. And it was the first time, when I became a writer on the show, it was the first time that I thought, oh, I'm above average at this. I feel like the show's been carrying me, and now I can finally hopefully give something back of value to thank them for keeping me around.
I'm imagining that hosting Weekend Update was really good preparation for having your own show.
Yes. The nice thing for me about Weekend Update was, for the first time, you just got to be yourself as opposed to playing characters. And
right.
And again, there are some people at SNL, you know, I worked with people like Kristen Wiig or Bill Hader or Fred Armisen, who put on a wig and completely transform into another human being. Whereas I always just looked like a guy in a wig. So I was very happy doing things like that. It was also, I was really lucky to be doing it with my best friend on the show, who was Amy. And so I felt immediately comfortable. She had done it with Tina, and I came in to fill in once Tina left. So Amy was a pro at that point, and that was a great amount of comfort for me. And yeah, it was basically just, again, what my show is now, which is just sitting at a desk and telling jokes. The more you do it, the more reps you have, the better you're gonna get at it. And so I was really lucky to do it at SNL. Plus, the difference now is, you know, our show is live to tape, but it's not live. So right. I will never feel as nervous doing my show as I did doing SNL, even when I did it for 13 years.
So in the midst of that, which is the most stressful job you've ever
yeah.
had, you met your wife. Who,
yeah.
We were talking about this before, who's like the star of a rom-com. Like, she's a human rights lawyer who looks like a movie star.
Yeah.
So how did you guys meet, and how did you start a relationship while you were doing the hardest job of your life?
I met her at a wedding. I met her at Chris Kattan's wedding. We sat next to each other the second night of the wedding, and people were asking us how long we'd been a couple. Like, we genuinely, like, had that chemistry from the beginning. But my wife was a prosecutor at the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office. She prosecuted sex crimes. And this is how impossible I am to live with. I would be the one in a bad mood at the end of the day. Like, I'd come home if my monologue was bad and just, like, throw myself down on the couch. She'd say, what's wrong? And I would say, I have two jokes didn't work. And then like an hour later, I'd ask her how her day was, and she'd say, really rough. We put a pimp in jail. I'd be like, Anyways, I don't know why those jokes didn't work, so.
And did you watch late night shows a lot? Like, did you, let's put it this way. Did you have a vision of having a show like this?
No, I had a vision. My dream was always SNL. Yeah. And once I was on SNL, my dream was Weekend Update. I did not think much past it. And I watched Letterman in high school. I watched Conan in college.
Yeah.
But SNL was really the show that was the biggest influence on me.
Uh-huh.
And I never thought this would be something I'd end up doing.
And so tell us about what it was like when this ended up happening.
Well, Lorne, the thing about Lorne Michaels is he's, every conversation you have with Lorne, it feels like a follow-up conversation to a conversation that never happened. So he's talking about details that you don't have. I remember I was doing stand-up somewhere in Ohio, and the New York Post had written an article saying that Jimmy was going to take over for Leno and I was going to take over for Jimmy. And I just assumed it was a rumor. And Lorne called me in Ohio and he said, look, you know, I think you'll be good at it. And over time, you'll find your footing and it'll be good. And I was like, what is happening right now? And it was, so my memory of being offered the job was taking 3 days to realize that I had been offered the job. Which also happened when I got hired for SNL. I had a really just cryptic meeting with Lorne. I had auditioned, and he brought me in to meet him. And I just remember at one point he said, so obviously we're going to want to see how you look in wigs. And so I assumed there was this wig test I had to pass. And then years later, I mentioned it to someone, and they said, we never do a wig test. And I was like, why would he say that? And I got hired at the same time as someone else. And I remember that person I met up for drinks afterwards, because we had flown out together. And he walked in and said, I got hired. And I was heartbroken because I figured if he got hired, that meant I didn't. And it wasn't until 4 days later that I realized I got hired. And I just was more pessimistic than this other person who just assumed he would nail the wig test when the time came.
And so SNL was like this huge goal. And you've accomplished so much. It sounds like you've accomplished more than you meant to.
Oh, this is all going way better than I thought it would. Yeah.
Okay.
If you take away anything, don't be that I was like, I feel like I'm about 75% of what I deserve. Yeah, this is beyond my wildest dreams.
This is beyond your wildest dreams.
Yeah.
We were lucky enough to have your friend Amy Poehler here a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I asked her, are you surprised? Like, did you envision all this? And she said, yeah.
Yeah.
This was the plan. You, no.
No, but that was the great thing about being friends with Poehler, is Poehler was this confidence wave that you could just kind of coast off. She was the person on the Tour de France team that was in the front, just like biking against the wind, saying like, I'm gonna win this fucking yellow jacket. And the rest of us were just behind her saying, this is great. I love being behind this person who's so sure. Now, by the way, I should also point out, I also expected it all for Poehler as well.
Right.
You know, she's Poehler. Of course, she should think it was going to happen for her. I had less confidence about it. And, you know, over time, it was just really important to find what my lane was and get better at a few things as opposed to try to be everything. I think that's one of the problems when you show up at SNL is you kind of think, oh, I'll be all the things. And then over time you realize, or maybe just one or two of the things and get really good at that.
But you have been all the things. Like you've done lots of stand-up.
Yeah, I do stand-up. I like doing stand-up. But this, I feel like this that I'm doing right now feels the closest to what I was meant to be doing. And that's a really nice thing. I mean, I think a lot of people end up doing jobs and thinking about if only I was doing that,
right?
I'd be crushing it. Like, there's no one else I look at now. And I think early in SNL, you tend to sort of compare and despair based on what other people are doing. And this is the first time that I've thought, oh, there's nothing else happening in show business right now that I'd rather be doing than this.
That's fantastic.
It's great. It took a long time to get there, but it's really, I'm really happy about it.
Seth Meyers appearing with Aria Levy at the New Yorker Festival. And in a minute, Seth talks about doing SNL with no less a guest star than Donald Trump. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite, Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
About 600,000 people go missing every year in the U.S., prompting family members to become amateur detectives. On the trail of one missing person is journalist Tanya Mosley.
Why do you think you hesitated when we first met in telling me the full details about your mother's disappearance?
It's heartbreaking. I didn't want to break your heart.
I'm Kai Wright. Tanya Mosley joins me next time on Notes from America. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Every October, the New Yorker throws a festival of live events bringing our writers together with the biggest names in politics and culture and entertainment. In 2017, staff writer Aria Levy spoke with Seth Meyers, the host of NBC's Late Night and a longtime veteran of Saturday Night Live.
Okay, so during your time at SNL, you also started another very significant relationship in your life with a reality television star named Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Tell us about your impression of him when he hosted.
So he hosted, I think, in 2004, 2005. And he was a lovable buffoon, is the only way to put it. There was nothing scary about him. He was just kind of a big old dope who had no sense of humor, but would say the words you put in front of him, and it was kind of fun. Like, oh, this is a human who will do things you ask him to. We ended up doing... We did a sketch together where he played my dad. We did a sketch called Donald Trump's House...
You wear a wig.
I wore a wig that looked like him. It's very eerie now.
Hi. Welcome to Fathers and Sons, the show that teaches and discusses how positive communication between fathers and sons can make this special relationship between two men even better. I'm Peter Fleck, and this is my dad, Gary. There's no reason why sensitivity and warmth can't be key ingredients between fathers and sons. That's why we're here today on Fathers and Sons. Isn't that right, Dad?
You could really cut that intro in half. Boy, it's way, way too long.
Okay, here we go again. All right. It's a bit long, you're right.
You don't have to tell me when I'm right. I know when I'm right. Now let's do it. Come on, this is just a miserable way to spend a Sunday.
Myself and a bunch of other people, including Amy Poehler, Mike Schur, who is a great showrunner now for The Good Place, who created Parks and Rec as well, wrote a sketch called Donald Trump's House of Wings, where he basically talked about opening a chicken wing restaurant.
Can you do this song?
Yeah, well, it was to the Pointer Sisters' Jump. It was, so he would talk about his chicken wing place, and he was wearing like a yellow suit. And then we would come out, me, Maya, Keenan, and Amy, in chicken eggs, like chicks coming out of eggs. And it was, Trump, you know these wings will make you happy. Trump in, you know these wings will fill you up. Trump, if you want blue cheese, it'll be a dollar extra. Donald Trump's House of Wings. It's really fun. And it was really great, thank you. He didn't until, and this is very, this is the, looking back, is the most haunting part of it. He had no sense of humor, or I shouldn't say, like, I don't mean to say he was humorless. He didn't know what was funny until an audience told him. And so he thought that sketch was so dumb. And then we did it, and the audience, like, there was, like, an applause break, and you just watch him light up. And then he starts dancing, yep. And he just go, and you just realize in the same way that he, like, became a candidate based on audience reaction, like, that, oh, whoa, wall works, I'll do wall. tonight I'm going to do Wall. Wall is a big pit. And so he's just that. He just chases where the laughs are and where the reaction is. And so that was, looking back, that was the weird part.
Let's watch something from when the idea that he'd still control the free world was funny. This is Seth doing the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Can we see the clip from the Correspondents' Dinner, please?
And then, of course, there's Donald Trump. Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke. Donald Trump often appears on Fox, which is ironic because a fox often appears on Donald Trump's head. If you're at the Washington Post table with Trump and you can't finish your entree, don't worry, the fox will eat it. And if I can for a moment talk about the birther issue, when did we get so suspicious about where people were born? A USA Today poll last week said 38% of Americans think the president was definitely born in the US. In the same poll, in the very same poll, only 5% more said Donald Trump was definitely born in the US. Has it reached the point where Americans only think something was someone was born here if they saw it? I know I was born here, and I know my younger brother was born here. But when it comes to my older brother, I can only take him at his word. Gary Busey said recently that Donald Trump would make a great president. Of course, he said the same thing about an old rusty birdcage he found. Donald Trump owns the Miss USA pageant, which is great for Republicans because it will streamline their search for a vice president. Donald Trump said recently he has a great relationship with the blacks, though unless the blacks are a family of white people, I bet he's mistaken.
Trippy.
So, Donald Trump looks like he wants to eat your liver with a nice Chianti. So did you feel fear the next time you saw him?
So a couple things. One, I could not see him. That room, it's like, it would be like right now seeing if somebody here, you can't see the faces. And I walked off stage that night and I got a call from Al Franken, who I had talked to ahead of time about that night because he had actually hosted it twice. And he called and he said, you did a great job. If you see Donald Trump, run away. I saw him like 3 days later in New York at an event. And I had this real moment. And I do feel like this is something that Lorne Michaels tries to instill in you when you work on the show. Like, don't write a joke about somebody that you feel is so unfair and so out of bounds that if you saw them, you would be ashamed to see them. I felt like everything I wrote that night was totally in bounds because, again, you know, this was the height of him saying the president wasn't burned here, which is, you know, really the root of where we are today. And so I walked over to him with, like, a big old grin on my face. And I said, hey, I want to thank you for being such a good sport the other night, even though he had not been a good sport. And he had not been a good sport afterwards and had sort of gone on Fox and Friends and talked about what a terrible job I did. And I gave him the opportunity to be cool about it. And in front of a bunch of people, he didn't take that opportunity. He said something along the lines of, you were too rough. The president was funny, but you were too rough. You crossed the line. You were too rough. And then I said, well, thanks anyway, and walked away. And then I felt just like sweat. Because again, the other thing is just a big guy. You forget. He's kind of like just like a big, it's like a bear. Like a circus bear that just figured out how to walk and is just working through motor skills. But it was, the other thing though I should say is, a lot was written in the run-up to this election. There was even a piece in The New Yorker, I can't remember who wrote it, I wish I could, about how that night was what set
right,
him on thing.
Right.
And some of those articles would mention me, but some of them, New Yorker included, left me out and said the reason Trump is running is because Obama made fun of him that night.
Right.
And that always made me really angry because I wanted to share credit for tricking. I helped trick an unelectable person to run for president.
Except for one thing.
And then he won. And when he won, my first thought was, this is Obama's fault. I had nothing to do with it.
It was a wonderful night. Thank you for so much for being with
us. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.
Seth Meyers, host of Late Night, talking with New Yorker staff writer Aria Levy at the New Yorker Festival in 2017. You can find all of Ariel's writing for us at newyorker.com. And that's it for the show this week. In our next episode, Michael Shulman talks with three terrific actors who have played the president, including Tony Goldwyn, the president who appears naked on Scandal. You won't want to miss that.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mike Lee Rao, Stephen Valentino, and Richard Yeh, with help from Rhonda Sherman, David Ohana, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.